Hi, I'm Britt Garner.
And I'm Rob Spall.
Welcome to Nature Insight.
Speed dating with the future.
Speed dating works best when the information that's shared has value and resonates with the person who's listening. That's exactly our hope for this podcast, that the insights shared by our guests resonate with you and hopefully help to change how we all relate to nature and our shared future. I'm a science teacher in New York City.
And I'm the head of communications at IPBES, the World Biodiversity Platform for Science and Policy in Bonn, Germany.
So, Rob, we closed our first season speaking with the wonderful Brigitte Baptiste, one of the co-chairs of the IPBES Values Assessment. And that's the ongoing assessment looking into how we, humans, value the rest of nature and its contributions to people, and the implications of all this for the policies that affect biodiversity. It is a huge undertaking.
That's right, Britt. Your interview last season with Brigitte really got me thinking about how complicated it can be to consider different values of nature. Even the concept of nature itself, which I think many of us just take for granted, is culturally constructed. I mean, in some languages, the concept of nature doesn't even exist, certainly not separate from us. So how can we find ways to discuss a common understanding of values in the middle of such complexity?
And these are such important issues for us to understand, aren't they? I mean, so many of our decisions and actions affect nature, but if we don't understand the different values of nature, how can we begin to know the consequences of our choices? And in this, our second season, the values of nature keep coming up in our conversations, no matter what we're talking about. It seems to be the undercurrent of every aspect of our relationship with the rest of the natural world.
It has. It's been a golden thread throughout the season. So we thought we'd check back in with the team behind the IPBES Values Assessment and dig even deeper into the topic. After more than 4 years of work, the assessment is almost done, and it's expected to be published later this year in July 2022. Although we can't preview the findings for you yet, there's still so much about the assessment that's worth knowing.
Indeed. I got to sit down with another co-chair of the Values Assessment, Professor Patty Balvanera. Patty works at the Institute for Ecosystem and Sustainability Research at the National Autonomous University of Mexico. She researches the links between biodiversity, ecosystem services, and human well-being. With all this talk about values, I started by asking her about why we should investigate values in the first place and why they matter for the protection of biodiversity.
Well, I think there are multiple values of exploring values. On the one hand, the values of nature actually underpin the drivers of change in biodiversity. So assessing the values of nature is also a key element to understand why biodiversity is being lost. If we think that nature is a trash where I can dump all my plastics, everything coming out of my house, or is a source of food and products that never gets exhausted, or if I think about nature as part of me or part of my family or part of who I am, and so I would relate to nature in the same ways that I relate to my family in terms of care, being responsible, in terms of reciprocity. That changes completely the way we think about nature, we relate to nature, and that policies are designed. But also, values tend to clash with each other, and there are so many conflicts in the use of nature and understanding why these conflicts, what are the values that are at stake and how to address these conflicts will allow us to have many tools.
So we speak about there being so many different values involved in these choices and decisions and planning. Can you help us understand what those different types of values are?
I would like to use the example of a valley and the construction of a dam to think about these very different values. So in general, you have water and a valley where you can put a dam. And it's quite common, the goals for making these dams go all the way from generating hydroelectricity or having water to irrigate crops or to deliver water to cities. No? And the goals and the values associated to this have to do with, of course, generating electricity, the growth of economic, the growth domestic product, having more jobs. And there's all these ideas about these will lead maybe to increased food security, to poverty reduction.
Sure.
But then when we assess what is going to happen there, on the one hand, upstream, the valley gets flooded, and downstream, there are very important changes in the flow of water. So from the biodiversity perspective, there are very important changes. So a lot of forest, for instance, is lost when it gets flooded, and many of the fish get really affected because the quality, the timing of the water and of the water flows change completely. So the population of fish can change very dramatically, just to mention one of the types of species that get really affected. But then there's other dimensions that are also important. For instance, in the Amazon around the Belo Monte Dam, the areas that would be flooded were sacred burials. And the area where the dam was going to be constructed had these sacred waterfalls that are so important for these peoples. But also, as there are new jobs, there are also very important changes in the livelihoods. For instance, in the Magdalena River, with the creation of the dam, the fisher communities had completely a different perspective, where they were not able to fish in the same way and to support their livelihoods. And so you have all these very diverse values at stake when you think about a particular piece of nature. And sometimes we just don't think about this huge diversity at the same time.
And how did it come about originally? What was the origin story behind this values assessment?
When the IPES conceptual framework was crafted, the discussions were quite interesting in terms of the very different ways in which the members of the team discussing the conceptual framework conceptualized nature. It was clear that the ways in which we think about nature, the benefits from nature, and what kind of life do we want to have in the context of nature are so different. And it really opened a very important door to explore the needs for understanding this better. And so this led us between 2014 and 2016 to work on a values guide. It was a document directed to IPES, to people working in IPES, for those who were undertaking any assessment to be mindful about these very different ways to understand nature, benefits from nature, and a good quality of life, and to guide the work. By then, the regional assessments were ongoing, and little after that, the global assessment got started.
I know that for me, doing a PhD about biodiversity conservation, looking at wildlife management, so much of wildlife management is actually human management. It really is the choices and decisions and behavior of people. And I didn't realize until taking a philosophy course that everything I was doing was actually values all the way down. And it completely changed how I conceptualized all of these questions about our interactions with the rest of the living world. Did you have any professionals or any perspectives that really changed it for you?
Absolutely. So in my career, I have interacted more and more with interdisciplinary teams. So I started working with economists and anthropologists and geographers. But for the values guide, we really had to work with philosophers. And it was, as you say, as an ecologist, it was a very interesting experience to have our very basic assumptions questioned, to be mindful of the fact that we were not even aware of how many assumptions were underlying particular positions or statements, and to question those and to really think about the values and to really make very clear the fact that there's no single way, there's not a basic assumption about how to think about nature, but there are very different ways to think about it and the huge implications it has.
Those pesky philosophers coming in and asking us to defend and define the very basic pieces. In our first season of the podcast, in episode 6, we got to speak to one of your co-chairs, Brigitte Baptiste, and she spoke about hoping that the calls for leaders of Indigenous peoples and local communities to contribute to the assessment would actually result in a strong representation of worldviews, specifically from those previously, you know, not in the room and not in the conversation. As you are now nearing the end of this assessment process, do you feel that you have achieved this goal?
Yes, I think we really have made a huge effort along these lines. No? So, for instance, the team of expert authors, we have 85 authors from 47 countries who speak 51 languages.
That's incredible.
And so this is already quite diverse. On top of that, we had more than 200 contributing authors who contributed small pieces and more than 8,000 comments from reviewers across so many countries. So we really had a very diverse team and a very diverse source of information. But also a very important step forward was the work with Indigenous peoples and local communities. So on the one hand, I think this is the first time in an IBES assessment that two of the authors are themselves Indigenous knowledge holders. But also in IBES, we generally undertake several dialogues with different teams from Indigenous and local communities. In this case, we had three dialogues, but what was really novel is that we opened a call for contributions and the Indigenous knowledge holders sent us directly their contributions, the text or the audios or the different representations of their own explorations of what the assessment was trying to do.
And it was incredible to watch as someone outside of the process, because I remember actually being on Twitter and seeing tweets calling for submissions and calling for knowledge holders. And it was just so exciting to think about how many different views were being elicited and solicited to be a part of this. And it's also daunting to think about pulling together so many different worldview, so many different potential values, and have them together in one assessment. Is it about finding common ground between those, or is it something else?
You're right. I think the one part of the assessment that is really daunting is the huge diversity of sources of information, disciplines, perspectives, also implications. And the same happens to the decision makers on the ground. They have all this diversity of values and how to do about it. We're really talking about apples, oranges, and dinosaurs in a way. You can compare, if you want, the increase in jobs and the contributions to GDP growth, but how do you put in the same place the role of these sacred burials, of these sacred waterfall, or
right,
the impacts on the livelihoods? So rather than trying to put together, you know, in a very nicely neat box, we actually try to show the wrinkles, the things that could not be ironed, the tensions between the different perspectives, the different types of values and the challenges with trying to compare them.
It's so interesting to think that part of bringing things together is actually acknowledging the tensions and acknowledging the differences. And it seems that really decision makers need to take these into account, but that it's okay that it's hard, because it is not, as you said, about ironing it out, but rather acknowledging the wrinkles and maybe even celebrating them in a certain way.
Absolutely. And really understanding all these diversity, the different voices, the when they are conflicting, why they are conflicting, how they are conflicting, but also how they are so hard to compare and what to do about it. and how to really give voice to those values that we normally do not listen to or don't think they are so important in everyday life.
There are so many different authors and perspectives at the front end of this, but at the back end of this, there will be many different stakeholders and audiences that will actually receive and view this assessment. How can different audiences use the values assessment once it is out?
Our job is to provide a roadmap, a toolkit to navigate this complexity and to really inform decision based on understanding this complexity, using the tools available to adequately represent this diversity, to embed this diversity into decisions, and then to operationalize the design, for instance, of policies that take into account this diversity. And so the toolkit we are providing has, for instance, specific guidance on policy instruments that are already available, that have been more or less used and have X and Y potential, or that have X or Y limitations.
Coolest toolbox ever. I know that it's been about 4 years of this journey for you and others working on this values assessment. If you had to think back and kind of find some of the most positive moments or things that have stood out along this journey, what would you say comes to mind?
On the first hand, on a very personal perspective, I do remember when we launched the assessment and we were at the first author meeting, actually in Mexico City, the four co-chairs, we were there, and I just felt, and I think we share this feeling, that this is probably one of the most important endeavors of our life. And it is really such a huge and ambitious project. And on the other hand, it is so relevant to really be able to convey the different needs of different people, what they value, what are the voices that have not been heard, how to show these different values, how to navigate this complexity and make decisions that can really get us to a different position, to a future in which we are able to, for instance, to achieve the sustainable development goals, in which it's about, of course, maintaining life on Earth, but also people having their needs met, and also addressing the very structural and deep inequities that are found today in terms of who is most affected by the loss of biodiversity and who wins.
It's incredible to think that on top of all of this, half of the time was done during a pandemic and that there were a ton of considerations. And I mean, how did you all pull it off? How did this truly keep going?
Yeah, we are so deeply thankful to our authors. I mean, it has really hit everyone, either directly being sick, directly being faced with very, very painful losses, but also taking care of kids at home, taking care of the elder and your six family members. I mean, it's been so hard. And I think at least there's two very important elements that have helped us. On the one hand, we have a wonderful support team. There's this team of young, energetic people who, I mean, they just do anything. They would do lit reviews. They would organize meetings. They will help refine figures. I mean, they would do so many things. But also, every time they have this smiling face, they will send us monthly newsletters where they make the most amazing opening statements and jokes that warm our hearts. I mean, they're really amazing. And the second thing is that the team has really come together as a very organic and very strong team, a body of people for which we care for each other, we have very strong bonds, we can count on each other. And it's been such an amazing personal adventure to really count on all these people, to learn from their everyday life, how COVID is doing, how the work is doing, what are the implications of what we're doing for their very specific context. And we have really a wonderful community.
The sort of care and heart that you all are sharing with each other, I know, is also what you are sharing with the work. And I think it's really going to show in this final values assessment from IPBIS. And I simply cannot wait. And thank you deeply to you and all that are making it possible.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
You can really hear Patty's passion for the values of values. One thing that stood out for me was how committed she is to providing a toolkit that can help people navigate these conflicting values of nature. I mean, as Hien and Go mentioned in episode 2 of this season, the last thing we want to do at IPBIS is to produce dust collectors, reports that just sit on a bookshelf without being useful to anyone.
I feel that so strongly. And after talking to Patty, I wanted to get a better idea of how the results and key messages from such a huge assessment would be used in the real world. And for that, I went to David Cooper, the Deputy Executive Secretary at the CBD.
Ah, the CBD. That's the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity. It's a global treaty that protects the diversity of life on Earth. And they develop global policies and guidelines and frameworks that help us to conserve biodiversity. We've worked really closely with the CBD since IPBIS's creation.
And as David has been part of the CBD since its origin, I was first curious to know how much importance they place on the values of nature in the negotiations between governments.
Consideration of values is an essential part of the convention's work. After all, the convention brings together countries and people from all over the world. And so people with different perspectives, different interests, different insights. So it's essential that those different perspectives and worldviews are taken into account, not only to get agreement on those global policies, but then perhaps even more importantly, to get something that can be implemented on the ground.
Can you think of how a values assessment by IPBIS could actually be used by the CBD groups in general?
Well, of course, a major part of the reason why we are losing biodiversity, why we're not investing sufficiently in its protection, why we tend to overexploit biodiversity, is that we're not properly valuing it. So we need to figure out how to reflect these values in decision-making that affects biodiversity. And of course, that's not only direct conservation actions. That's essentially everything we do in food and agriculture, everything we do in the way we manage landscapes and the oceans. And in general, this is already widely recognized by governments, the importance of values. And in fact, in the draft framework, the post-2020 Global Biodiversity Framework, there is a target on integrating the values of biodiversity. But it's not easy to do. And having a toolkit that can provide guidance to governments and other stakeholders, that will help in the implementation of this framework once it's agreed.
Sure. And not just the values, but the range of values, right? This idea of from local to global.
Absolutely. And in fact, one of the biggest challenges we'll have, even when we have this framework, is that while we know what needs to be done essentially at a global level to protect biodiversity, the actual action has to be national or in fact local. And so the challenge is how to reconcile these big changes that are needed globally with the interests and actions of people locally. We're looking forward to this assessment also in providing some tools, some guidance on how to bridge these different scales.
Absolutely. And most recently, we watched and heard a lot of this discussed at the COP26, the climate convention in Glasgow. The CBD is going to actually later this year have its own convention of the parties, COP15 in China. Do you think biodiversity still gets less attention than climate change? And if so, do you think a better understanding of different values could make a difference there.
If we look at Glasgow, we see that actually there was a lot more emphasis and focus on nature, on how important nature and nature-based solutions will be in addressing the climate crisis, but also recognizing how important addressing climate is to have a chance of reducing biodiversity loss. If we don't keep close to 1.5 degrees, then we really don't have much chance of halting biodiversity loss. So these two things are interrelated. And if we look at most people, you know, while us experts, if you like, and the international community is sort of divided up this into one convention and another convention, most people, I think, look at these things more together. You only have to look at some of the direct action campaigns. For example, one is called Extinction Rebellion, right? Having said that, I do think that nature is now getting more attention in its own right as well. And I think the current COVID-19 pandemic has also brought this to light, looking at how people have coped and managed during COVID and during the lockdowns. There's been an increased appreciation of the values of nature, the value of green spaces, for instance. And I think also the pandemic has provided opportunities for people to reflect on what is really important. In other words, what are their values and how they relate to nature?
Yeah, I think we've all sort of had moments to do that in these past couple years now. And even though we talk about what's happening at the global scale or the national scale, so much of values is personal and starts with understanding differences between and even among people. Even the same person might be conflicted or not be able to really piece apart the way that they value something in the living world.
For sure.
I'm curious, from all of your time with the CBD, what have you seen as some really moments of significance when we have this change in understanding of the values of nature?
As we've started to look at the causes of biodiversity loss, we start by looking at those immediate causes, whether it's overexploitation or land use change or invasive species or pollution or climate change. But then behind those, we're seeing the way societies work, the way economies work, our investment decisions, our consumption. But underlying those are our values. Values are behind everything we do as individuals, as businesses, as organizations. And as we increasingly recognize that we need to change those underlying patterns, we recognize the essential importance of values underneath that. So looking at values is really fundamental to get the transformational change that we need to achieve the agreed goals, to achieve our climate goals, our biodiversity goals, and indeed our broader goals of sustainable development.
I totally agree. Well, it's been a pleasure to learn from you. So thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
What struck me in both of the interviews is how important it is for us to look at our assumptions about the values that we ourselves ascribe to and how we go about using those values and perhaps questioning some of those values.
Oh, I completely agree. And let me just say, I think apples, oranges, and dinosaurs needs to be the next IPBIS assessment. One thing that was so clear from both of them is just how important this work is to them. I mean, they really do feel this is just one of the most important endeavors of their lives for both of them. And that makes perfect sense. If I were working on something like this, I would feel the exact same way. You know, we need this work because our values drive our behaviors. They drive our choices. And there's no way we can fully understand these choices, or better yet, even change our behaviors, unless we've really gotten into why we're valuing what we value.
You know, something David said, and I think it sounds simple, but it's so important. The idea that the major reason why we're losing biodiversity is because we're not properly valuing it. And that I think is as valid at a global level or a regional level, where these tools that the values assessment will provide will help decision makers at all levels better value nature in order so that we can perhaps protect it better.
Right. And what's so interesting with the pandemic is that I think in a way there has been this increased appreciation for, or perhaps just recognition of, what it means to be around the other, what inside and outside even means while dealing with our own isolations and societal pressure of trying to stay safe through now what has been multiple years. I mean, it's almost like asking, you know, how can we get people to appreciate or value nature more, but without needing to go through something as traumatic and disruptive as something like a pandemic?
For me, Britt, having grown up in South Africa, where I was really fortunate to be often in very direct contact with different ecosystems, different species, and with other parts of nature, it was when I moved with my family to Bangkok in Thailand, and we started living in this huge city of 14 million people, where the ecosystem that we were living in was so different from what I'd grown up with, not having access to the kinds of ecosystems and species and nature which I was used to, really, I think, was what drove home for me how much I value it.
I can tell you, moving from Montana to New York City, I have absolutely experienced something similar. And interestingly enough, there are some incredible bits of nature here, just as there were where I came from. And it's wild to see different manifestations of what nature means, whereas I am the constant. And it feels that no matter what habitat I'm in, valuing nature really does feel at the core of my own identity. And it was wonderful to speak to these experts about this from the science and policy aspect.
That's it for this episode of Nature Insight.
Thank you again to Patty Balvanera and to David Cooper for joining us in this episode.
In our next episode, I'll be speaking to Steve Pulaski, Professor of Ecological and Environmental Economics at the University of Minnesota, and we'll explore the relationship between nature and economics.
Ooh, very interesting stuff. Make sure you subscribe to Nature Insight so you don't miss it, and please rate and review us so we know what you think.
In the meantime, you can learn more about IPBES's work on ipbes.net or on any of our social media channels. Just search for @IPBES. That's @IPBES. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with the final installment of this season, episode 6.